From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, working in the urban mines, as far as 80 stories beneath the streets of New York, we talk with Thomas Kelly, who's written a new novel about his years as a sandhog. The sandhogs are the men who build the subway, sewer, and water tunnels and the foundations for bridges and skyscrapers. Also, Keith Richburg, a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, has written a memoir about his experience as an African-American reporting from Africa and how it affirmed his identity as an American. He'll tell us why he can no longer romanticize about Mother Africa. And David Bianculli tells us about the premiere of The Practice and the return of Easy Streets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bob Whitten. Authorities say at least 24 people were killed in the flurry of tornadoes that hit Arkansas over the weekend. Damage is extensive across the state, much of which has been declared a disaster area by President Clinton. The president plans to travel to his home state tomorrow to view the devastation. Hundreds of people have been left homeless as the cleanup continues. Lieutenant Colonel Sissy Lashbrook is with the Arkansas National Guard.
We're providing traffic control. You know, there's a lot of people that want to go in and see the area, and we're putting up manning points, checkpoints, only allowing authorized personnel and residents in to keep out people who don't need to be there. And also, we've had some problems with looting, so we're having some security efforts in that area.
Severe storms and flooding have claimed at least 19 lives in other states over the weekend, including Tennessee, Illinois, Ohio, and Kentucky. President Clinton says an Israeli plan to house Jews in historically Arab East Jerusalem, in his words, builds mistrust. His comment came in a White House meeting this morning with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Arafat says the housing construction plan is designed to isolate Jerusalem. Zairean rebel leader Laurent Kabila says he refuses to sign a ceasefire to stop the country's civil war until President Mobutu Sese Seko gets personally involved in the negotiations. Secret peace talks were held in Cape Town last week. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
Foreign pressure for a ceasefire has been intense, with appeals coming from the UN, the Organization for African Unity, and many countries, including the U.S. International concern rose another notch over the weekend when the rebel advance reached the last remaining refugee camp in eastern Zaire. Aid workers say the Tingi Tingi camp is now empty. 150,000 or more Hutu refugees have fled into the forest and are cut off from all assistance. Many are sick and malnourished. The rebels claim to control the area and have offered the UN access so it can coax refugees to return to Rwanda. But Kabila says a ceasefire is out of the question until President Mobutu accepts to take part in full peace talks. Mobutu is at his villa in France. Aides say he will return to Zaire in a few days. This is Michael Scholar in Nairobi.
The Greece-Albania border is quiet. Customs officials say there has been no crush of Albanians trying to flee the violence that has overtaken their country. There have been fresh outbreaks since the first of the year, when many Albanians lost their life savings in a number of fraudulent investment schemes. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 3.08 at 6874.66. Trading is moderate, 187 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 0.66 currently at 1308.34. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, after an early decline, stocks have staged a turnaround, although weakness in the telecommunications sector is offsetting gains made by computer-related issues. Bloomberg's Paul Lynn reports.
Stocks were moving lower early in the session after weakness in the telecommunications sector. We had the Dow Industrials down as much as 50 points this morning, much of that decline because of a drop in shares of AT&T. That company warned of per-share earnings in the first quarter 10% below what it made in the fourth quarter. But stocks then staged a dramatic turnaround by midday as computer systems and semiconductor issues led the way in the broader market. Also, we have gains in railroad stocks on word that there could be an agreement this week allowing a friendly merger between CSX and Conrail. In the Treasury bond market, an industry report on manufacturing sent the price on the 30-year down on concern the economy may be picking up steam. This is Paul Lynn.
New Yorker magazine reports that GE is considering buying a small piece of Dow Jones, the company which publishes the Wall Street Journal. GE apparently would like to have the resources of Dow Jones available for NBC, CNBC, and MSNBC. CSX is reported ready to switch tracks in its struggle to obtain Conrail. Published reports say CSX today will go to the Conrail board with a proposal to pay $10.5 billion and split the freight line with rival Norfolk Southern. In addition to bringing Norfolk Southern in on the deal, CSX would be raising its bid $2 billion. Assembly lines will be quiet for an hour today at Renault plants in France, Belgium, and Spain. Workers called the hour-long strike after last week's surprise announcement that Renault is closing a plant in Brussels affecting some 3,100 workers. I'm Bob Witten, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tom Kelly spent 3 years working underground in the urban mines far below the city streets of New York. He worked with the Sandhogs, the men who built the subway, automobile, sewer, and water tunnels in New York City, and the foundations for the city's bridges and skyscrapers. Kelly worked on a particularly dangerous project, New York City Water Tunnel No. 3. 23 men were killed during the construction of the tunnel. Kelly used the money he made working on the tunnel and on other construction jobs to put himself through college. He earned a B.A. in political economy from Fordham University and a master's in public administration from Harvard. Now at the age of 35, he's written his first novel called Payback, based on his experiences underground. In this reading, the men are taking a train car down to where they work.
They passed 1 mile into the earth, then 2 miles and three. Overhead, life went on, oblivious to their endeavors, 80 stories beneath the streets and living rooms of the city. 4 miles in, the train stopped. Billy and the men stepped off. The man car started back toward the shaft. As it prepared for work, the sound of the train receded and the gang was alone, as remote as anyone would ever be in New York City. The mule barked instructions. Billy and the gang climbed up on the jumbo drilling platform with its 3 levels, 3 drills to a level. The drills were run by compressed air, weighed over 100 pounds each. Billy wrestled his drill into position. By the time he was set up, he was slathered in grease. The light was dim, the air worse than usual. Billy felt like he was breathing through wet wool. He stood a hair under 6 feet tall, and his hard hat scraped the raw rock ceiling above his head. He hunched slightly and, with Frankie holding his drill bit to the rock face, let rip. The other sandhog started drilling, taking up where the swing shift had left off. The howl engulfed them.
Would you give us a sense of what it's like to go down 80 stories beneath the surface of the city?
Well, I guess I can think about the first night I went down, and the shaft I went down the first night was only about 600 feet. But, you know, you've heard about it, and you know you're going under the ground, and you get on this cage with a bunch of other men, and all of a sudden you're going down, and you're going down. And, you know, you're expecting it to stop, and it doesn't for quite some time, and you get out. It's rather awe-inspiring, you know. I mean, the rock down there is 440 million years old, and human beings really aren't supposed to be there. So, I mean, with technology and whatnot, we can go down and build these tunnels now. But it's pretty, and in the book I describe early on a scene where a guy comes the first night, and he's a big, rough, tough guy, and he goes down on the cage, and he just won't get off. And that would happen on a regular basis. I mean, a lot of people don't know what to expect till they get down there, and a lot of people just, you know, don't really want to be there.
Oh, yeah, you know, I like the way you just described it. This is a place humans weren't meant to be.
Yeah, very audacious of us.
So, did you ever lose your confidence or lose your courage doing the work?
You know, that's a good question. Not really. You know, it's like, you know, you talk to cops, you talk to firefighters. You talk to people who do dangerous stuff, and the minute you start thinking, my God, this is dangerous, you're probably in big trouble. I mean, there were a couple incidents down there where I came very close to grievous injury. And maybe because I was young and stupid, I don't know, it didn't seem to be that big of a deal. You know, my mother was reading the book going, oh, my God, I never realized that was the kind of work you were doing. So it's a good thing she didn't know. I would have been flipping burgers in White Castle instead.
Well, what's the riskiest part of the work?
You know, working in the heading where you're doing the actual mining, you know, when you're drilling and blasting or and sinking shafts. I mean, but like I said, guys have been killed doing so many different things. You know, because when you're first tunneling, you know, the ground, you're not sure, you're never sure exactly how stable the ground is going to be. I mean, the engineers come in and they make assumptions, but, you know, you hit areas of bad rock and, you know, and there's been some major cave-ins. There was one, when it first started back in 72, there was a huge cave-in on the job where luckily no one was killed, but, you know, they had no idea they were about to hit that rock. So, I mean, just the fact that you're going into the earth, you're not really sure what you're going to be hitting.
And what are you actually doing down there? You're digging deeper and deeper for tunnels or to put supports in for skyscrapers. What else are you doing when you're working down there?
You know, mostly I work just doing straight tunnels. I've never worked on a major foundation for a skyscraper. I've worked on some smaller foundations. You know, and one is, you know, you're going down maybe 60 feet is deep, and the other you're down 800 feet. So it's really, you know, one is really mining. We used to have a saying, we go after the hole, not the coal. You know, it's really old-fashioned hard rock mining where you're really drilling and blasting. And although now that's been supplanted by something called the mole, which is a big underground digging machine that has made it much less labor-intensive.
When a newcomer was starting to work underground and wasn't sure of their footing or was lacking in confidence, would the other men pick up on that, and what would their reaction be?
Oh, they'd torture you.
you know, nice I didn't and tell sensitive, it, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't. I mean, you know, I mean, on the exterior, they're very gruff. I mean, I didn't tell anyone I was going to college until I was there for 6 months. That would have been the death knell. Yeah, you go to college, you know. So, I mean, you were sort of better off establishing yourself as a worker before you let anything skip about, you know, reading books at all day. But yeah, they, you know, it's like in most construction, you know, I used to compare it, it's almost like going, not as harsh, but it's kind of like going to jail or prison maybe where, you know, they're going to tease you and push you and just see how much they can take. And, you know, maybe they're bored and they just want to have fun with you, you know, I don't know.
So what would have been so terrible if the guys found out that you were going to college?
Well, it's not so terrible. I mean, there were other people down there who were going to school, but, you know, you wanted to... You know, there's this whole notion of, you know, the college boy thing where they think you're just down there interloping or maybe your daddy got you the job or something. So, you know, I wanted to be established just as a worker first. And then they were great. I mean, the guys, in particular the older guys who didn't have the chance, you know, that I had. I mean, guys who, you know, grew up in the Depression and came out of high school and went to World War II or went to Korea and, you know, came from backgrounds where nobody went to college, you know. And so a lot of them sort of vicariously, you know, lived through me in a sense that they really were very supportive. And, you know, if I had a test the next day, they'd say, all right, kid, go over there and hide for an hour, you know, read your book, you know, which was great. You know, they were very supportive, and I'll always be appreciative of that.
Well, so you'd be reading 800 feet underground?
Yeah, yeah, trying to hide from the boss, you know. Don't tell anyone.
Oh, that must have been interesting. So but you were a worker before you were a college student. Weren't you down doing the tunnel work for years before you went to college?
No, not the tunnels I started right before I went to college, but I had been in work in construction from about the time I was 16, so, and I didn't go to college till I was 21, so I had about 5 years of work experience before I went to college.
Why did you decide to go to college when you did?
I decided I didn't want to break rocks for the rest of my life, I guess. No, I always read a lot, and I didn't come from a background where, I mean, nobody I knew went to school. Both my brothers dropped out of high school. My parents dropped out of high school. So there wasn't like a very, you know, academic fast track. And it wasn't until I'd been out working for a few years and decided, And after my father died when I was 20, and all he ever said to us was, get an education, don't be like me, you know. And we kind of laughed at him. I mean, he went to ninth grade. What did he know, you know? And so I guess, you know, partly motivated out of guilt and all sorts of other feelings that maybe I'd let him down, I sort of went and... you know, started going to junior college at night and then realized that I wasn't as stupid as I thought I was and, you know, started to do okay. And then decided, you know, a lot of things. I remember reading how, you know, Jack London had found in his biography how when he was a young man he found that brain power lasts a lot longer than back power and gets paid a lot more. So I started to think along those selfish terms too. And yeah, it's, you know, the construction, and especially in the tunnels, I mean, it's tough, tough work. I mean, a lot of these guys, you know, it takes a very heavy toll after, you know, a number of years. So, I mean, you start to see that and start to realize that maybe you want to do other things, you know.
You said that you realized when you were in college that you weren't as stupid as you thought you were. What made you think you were stupid?
Well, you know, I mean, you grew up a certain way, and I think you see this, and, you know, I mean, like when I was in high school, you know, we barely went to school, we were always working, and the teachers were very fond of telling us how stupid we were and how we would be digging ditches for the rest of our lives, and the cops reinforced that, and, you know, there was a lot of sort of this negative, like, oh, you'll never amount to anything in life, and after a while, I think it kind of seeps in, and you start to believe it, you know, you develop a negative self-image or a low self-esteem that, you know, some people never get over. You know, I was lucky enough to sort of step back and be able to examine that and see what it meant and move beyond it. But it's tough. I mean, you see these, you know, kids coming up today, and it's, you know, it's sad. It's a lot of people never get past that. I was lucky.
At first, you didn't want the men you worked with to know you were going to college. Did you want your friends in college to know that you also worked underground doing construction and mining.
Yeah, I guess, you know, to a certain extent. Well, I mean, I never plugged in on the whole social scene because I was a little bit older and and whatnot, but sometimes it was kind of fun to sort of rub it in their face a little, I guess.
How?
Well, you know, a lot of them, you know, there were a lot of great students, you know, in various institutions as we went, but there were other ones who were just there because, you know, daddy was giving them the money, and they had no conception. And it was during the whole Reagan era, and a lot of them had this very superior attitude that I found, I don't know, almost borderline, wait a second, where did I find it? You know, they had an attitude of superiority that I found a bit abrasive, and they were so convinced that, you know, they should be there. Meanwhile, they were only there because someone else was footing the bill and taking care of everything. And they would look down on the, you know, the workers in the cafeteria or whatnot. So I, you know, I didn't respect that. And I felt like, hey, I'm doing my own thing. And I guess I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder, which, you know, I realized later can be a negative thing. But I was lucky that I channeled it in something positive, I believe.
Thomas Kelly is my guest. His new novel is called Payback. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Thomas Kelly. His new novel, Payback, is based on his experiences working underground, constructing a water tunnel far beneath the city streets of New York. Part of your novel, Payback, is about the construction rackets. And how do they work?
Well, I mean, there's so many different ways, you know. It can be as simple as one guy going on a job. There was a guy I know who told me this story. He was a carpenter shop steward on a job in New York back in the 80s. And the company was, subcontractor was trying to get them to really ease off on some of the rules, the work rules that made it, you know, a little less, in their eyes, efficient, I guess. And as far as the union was concerned, it made it a lot safer. I don't know the exact particulars, but he said, you know, a guy would come up to him and give him an envelope and say, here, this is for you. And he would just say, get lost, I don't want it. So they're trying to buy a guy like that off. And then, you know, he went home once to his local neighborhood bar, and he said he was sitting there, and a gentleman walks in. An older guy dressed very nicely in a camel hair coat and comes walking towards him, calls his name. And as he turns around, the guy pulls out a gun and points it at him. And he pulls the trigger and like a red light comes out and he laughs and he turns around and he walks out of the bar. And this guy was maybe crazy enough or stubborn enough to still say, you know, go screw yourself. But, I mean, so they can try to get to one person a level like that. Then it goes to a much higher level where, you've got bid rigging and, you know, all sorts of stuff. The amazing thing is probably not how widespread this is, but that it's not universal. I mean, a lot of people are very brave and just tell these people to get lost, you know. And I think they prey on the weak, so. And other times, you know, they'll get a piece of a contractor, perhaps, or maybe they'll have influence in a union and where they'll try and create some labor strife. But more often the stuff comes through, you know, a contractor will get a piece of a job and then all of a sudden, you know, he'll be going way over budget and everything else and milking it for everything he has. So, I mean, it's a variety of levels.
So what the mob is looking for when they infiltrate a construction company is money off the top.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, you're dealing with these jobs that are really, they're hundreds of millions of dollars. They have construction loans that are probably a couple million dollars a month. And a lot of times it's easier just to pay someone off, you know, than deal with the cost of any kind of delays, you know, can far outweigh the cost of giving some guy, you know, 10 grand a week in an envelope or whatever it might be.
So did you know people who actually worked for the mob?
Why are you asking so many questions, Derry?
You just tell me if you can't answer any of this. I mean, if you're better off not.
Yeah, I'm not bulletproof. No, you know, I know people who worked with people, but I never really... you know, it was something, there was always a guy on the job who was an ex-con who had been involved in something, but I never knew anyone who was actively doing anything in my experience.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about what it's like underground. What's the air like to breathe?
You know, it varies. I mean, they're supposed to have these exhaust systems put in, and I recently went down to the second stage of the third water tunnel, and the air was better than I ever remembered it, and supposedly they have a new fan system that works really well. And it really sort of depended on what you were doing. I mean, when you were drilling and it was kicking up a lot of dust, or after you blasted, you know, the air was very bad. Other nights, depending on the activity, I mean, like when you pour on concrete, you know, it's very hot and it's and the air is very tight, but, you know, the air is not too cloudy. If you're doing stuff like before you concrete, you do something called blowing bottom, which essentially you get these big air cannons and you mix with water and you blow all the muck. And as you're blowing the muck, it kicks up in the air and you literally can't see 4 feet in front of you. And what that is, you have to ensure a proper bind with the concrete. So you have to get the rock so it's really glistening, so there's no dirt at all. So, I mean, if you're doing something like that, the air is just, you know, it's horrible. I mean, you can hardly breathe down there. And other nights, you know, if the excavation's been done and you're doing something like concreting, like I said, it's not as bad. So it really depended on the activity. And then sometimes, you know, the companies wouldn't, you know, if they were vigilant and were keeping the air, you know, the exhaust systems working, you know, that made a big difference too. Sometimes they didn't seem to care as much.
What would you wear to protect your eyes and your lungs?
Not much. The eyes, I mean, if you're doing something, you know, chipping or drilling, I mean, you really wanted to wear goggles because you get a lot of rock kickback in your face. But it's, you know, a lot of guys don't, which I think is kind of crazy. I always did. And the masks, you really, they give you like those cotton white masks, which I really don't think do much. They help a little bit, but in terms of silicosis, they don't filter out the smallest, the microns, which really do the damage to your lungs. So,
is there a lot of illness from working underground?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know any retired sand hogs who aren't out on a silicosis or a caisson's disease disability. And besides, I mean, everyone's got rheumatism and arthritis and, you know, just from working in the damp for so long. But the silicosis is really the most virulent and debilitating of the diseases. And that's essentially, they also call it white lung disease, which you get from breathing silica. And essentially, it eats the elasticity out of your lungs, I guess is the best way to describe it. So, and it's something you can get. I mean, there were instances during the Depression when they were building some dams down south and drilling through high silica content to do tunnels where guys died from it in a matter of months. So, I mean, it can be extremely deadly. Usually it takes a matter of years and you end up, like I said, very debilitated.
What's it like after a day's work when you're resurfacing back to the ground?
You know, it always felt good coming up, you know, to I think, like I said, you never realize how sweet New York City air can taste, you know?
Yeah, well, not many people talk about how sweet New York City air is.
Yeah, so you would come up, and it, you know, it depended. I mean, if you were working, I worked both swing shifts and graveyards, so a lot of times swing shift we would come up, and especially on payday, we'd head down to the local bar and cash our checks and have a few drinks and swap stories, and, you know, it was a lot of fun.
What was your favorite soap while you were working underground?
My favorite what?
Soap.
Soap?
Yeah.
You mean soap opera?
No, I mean to get clean
soaps.
After.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they have what's called a hog house. So when you come out of the tunnel, there's a shower right there. So, you know, most other construction jobs, you leave and you go home. But sand hogs, it's part of the contract. There's always a locker room on site. So you would come up, and they had this real, like, horrible industrial stuff that you could basically wash a battleship with, I guess.
Was lucky your skin can take it.
Yeah. I might end up, you know, the guys probably got sick from that in the long run.
Yeah. What's it like during blasting, and how much of the impact do you feel? Maybe you could describe that whole process when you're underground.
Sure. I mean, the blasting, what happens is you drill and you load a chute, and then you come back, and it depends on how much you're shooting, but usually you pull back, say, you know, 300 or 400 feet, maybe 500 feet, depending on how much you're shooting. Because the blast is designed in a way that first it blows the bottom out. It's all in time sequence. It's not just one big bang. I mean, it's hundreds of timed explosions going off. And so it's really like a ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-boom, and it builds to a crescendo. And so you don't have a lot of, it's designed in a way you don't have a lot of shrapnel, so you don't have to actually get out of the tunnel. I mean, it all kind of caves in on itself. But the noise, I mean, the first night I was down there when they blasted, it's almost indescribable. There's no way you'll ever hear anything as loud. I mean, first of all, you're using, you know, 100 pounds or more of explosives, and then you're in a very tight space. So yeah, the sound is incredible, and what happens is the air just gets sucked past you, and, you know, from the concussion, and it's, you know, the first time you think you're gonna die. I mean, the whole thing's gonna collapse. How could you have this powerful an explosion and the tunnel still be, you know, standing afterwards? So it's a pretty overwhelming experience.
Have you ever been working during a cave-in?
No, I was actually hit, though, in the head with a beam that fell and was hospitalized briefly with a slight concussion, and I was knocked out. I was walking down the tunnel one night, and nice as could be, next minute I know I'm on a stretcher. And what happened was they shore up the ceiling with sort of steel supports, and they put in, like, railroad ties. And one fell. Luckily, I was wearing a hard hat, you know, and I was only knocked out. I wasn't hurt too badly. If I didn't have a hard hat on, I probably would have been killed.
How long were you out of work?
Couldn't afford to stay out. I was back the next night with a stiff neck.
Now, did you think, maybe I won't go back?
You know, thank God I was young and dumb enough. No, you know, I needed the money, and it was, you know, you think, okay, this happened, it means it's probably not going to happen tomorrow, you know. I mean, the scariest thing that I ever did down there was, and I described this, I used this scene in the book. We were working in a shaft, and they were cutting out the shaft steel, and we were on a platform that's suspended by cables. And a piece of the steel shaft, a piece of the steel support that was being lifted out, broke off and fell. And we were, you know, we were in the shaft, and we were on the bottom of this two-level platform. And you know something's coming down, and it's loud, and it's screaming, it's banging off the walls, and you just stand there in those few seconds and know there's absolutely nothing you can do. And I mean, that was a pretty terrifying moment. And you know, one guy actually that was there that night, no one was hurt, luckily. I mean, people were banged up a little bit, but no one was hurt seriously. One guy never came back. And he had been working down there for 20 years, so.
During those few seconds when you saw what was happening, did you freeze? Did you try to duck?
Yeah, you know, an eerie calm. I just sort of stood there and said, you know, I guess there's realization that you know there's nothing you can do. And the, you know, the one guy who never came back, he sort of took it a little worse than others. He sort of had a reaction to it, you know, and then he left and he never came back. But for me, it was just, you know, I kind of held my breath, you know.
And what happened afterwards? Was this sense of, like, ecstasy? We're still alive?
Yeah, we hit the bar and drank pretty heavily that night, you know. It was like, wow. Yeah, it could have been a lot worse.
Well, Tom Kelly, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Tom Kelly's new memoir is called Payback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with journalist Keith Richburg about how his experiences as a journalist in Africa changed his perspective on being African-American. Now he'd rather just call himself American. Also, TV critic Deva Bianculli takes a look at the premiere of The Practice and the return of Easy Streets. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many African Americans regard Africa as a spiritual home. After spending 3 years in Africa, Keith Richburg had the opposite reaction. He thanks God he's American. He explains why in his new memoir, Out of America, A Black Man Confronts Africa. He was the Washington Post Nairobi bureau chief from 1991 to 94. During those years, he traveled across the continent, covering such stories as civil wars in Somalia and Rwanda, the last days of apartheid in South Africa, and the AIDS epidemic. Richburg is now the Post's Hong Kong bureau chief. He knows that one of his ancestors was an African who was taken to the Caribbean as a slave. Generations down the line, one of his descendants was taken to South Carolina. Richburg's father moved from there to Detroit. Here's a reading from the opening of Richburg's memoir.
And so it was that I came to be born in Detroit, and that 35 years later, a black man born in white America, I was in Africa, birthplace of my ancestors, standing at the edge of a river, not as an African but as an American journalist, a mere spectator, watching the bloated bodies of black Africans cascading over a waterfall. And that's when I thought about how, if things had been different, I might have been one of them, or might have met some similarly anonymous fate in one of the countless ongoing civil wars or tribal clashes on this brutal continent. And so I thank God my ancestor survived that voyage. Does that sound shocking? Does it sound almost like a justification for the terrible crime of slavery? Does it sound like this man has forgotten his African roots? Of course it does, all that and more. And that is precisely why I have tried to keep this emotion buried so deep for so long, and why it pains me so now to put these words in print for all the world to see. But I am writing this so you will understand better what I am trying to say. It might have been easier for me just to keep all of these emotions bottled up inside. Maybe I should have just written a standard book on Africa that would have talked broadly about the politics, the possibilities, the prospects for change. But I'm tired of lying. And I'm tired of all the ignorance and hypocrisy and the double standards I hear and read about Africa, much of it from people who've never been there, let alone spent 3 years walking around amid the corpses. Talk to me about Africa and my black roots and my kinship with my African brothers, and I'll throw it back in your face, and then I'll rub your nose in the images of the rotting flesh.
Keith Richburg, I have to say, you didn't read that in an angry voice, but the words are very angry.
There was a lot of anger there because, as I say in the book, so much of what I see and read about Africa is just so wrong. And I really felt that there was a need to shock people, to get them to look at the rest of this book and to listen to what I had to say. And I wanted them to focus on some of these images.
What are some of the things you saw in Africa that made you feel so repelled?
You know, what it really boils down is to just the inhumanity of man against fellow man that I saw there. And it started out when I first went into Somalia, and I was there during the famine that most people might remember, 1991, 92. And not only was it a famine, but it was a man-made famine. I walked around and watched gunmen keeping entire villages held hostage while people starved to death, literally in front of my eyes. I saw, after the American Marines intervened in Somalia, how the entire operation turned into a guerrilla war just because of the opposition of a few armed factions, when in fact this was an intervention that was really this there to save people's lives. You know, I saw Rwanda. I saw some of the most horrific scenes of massacres there. As I would come up on them afterwards, you'd see in churches the blood splattered across the altar where people had been butchered, where they went to take refuge. And then in Rwanda, walking around among the cholera epidemic, watching bodies being dumped in a river, bodies being dumped in mass graves for burial. And in Zaire, you know, that was one of the more interesting places because Zaire was not at the time in the middle of a civil war. But there also I was able to see some of the horrific decay in that city, Kinshasa, which could have been one of the great cities in Africa. And it was just completely overrun by destruction, despair. You could see elephant grass literally growing between the buildings that were standing unused. And it was all because of greed, corruption. And it was sort of that, like I said, the inhumanity, the greed, the corruption that really distressed me about Africa.
You seem to have left Africa hating all of Africa, not just hating the greed and corruption within it.
You know, as I say in the book, I left without any hatred towards the people, because it was the people who I felt worst about. It was the innocent, struggling, hard-suffering Africans who I felt were being betrayed by their own systems, their own governments. I left with very bad feelings about the place, but in a lot of ways, though, it's I think what I wrote was a positive book, because what it did for me, being there for 3 years and 3 months, was help me reaffirm my own identity, and that's an identity as an American, and that's why the book is called Out of America.
You write that in Somalia you learned what it's like to be a black reporter in Africa. How do you think your position compared to the position of white reporters covering the same stories?
It was a double-edged sword. In some cases, and Somalia is one I can think of, there were times when a black reporter could go out, not identify himself immediately as a reporter, and be able to walk the streets, not draw attention as a white reporter might draw attention. And those were during the times when it was unsafe for foreigners to be there. I could disguise myself as a local, so to speak. That was the benefit. There were other times when it was clearly a detriment, and I must say that the times when it was a detriment being black in Africa outweighed the times when it was a benefit. The problem is, as in Somalia, when there's a clan war, a faction war, a tribal war going on anywhere in the continent, if you're black, you automatically are assumed to be on one side or another. And often, if you're a black American, they can't distinguish where you're from, so they assume you're from the enemy tribe. It's very dangerous for black reporters to be in places where there are tribal wars going on. And I did learn that. I've had AK-47s rammed in my face and shoved into my chest, and people demanding to know which tribe I was. And that's the most dangerous, most frightening position you can ever be in.
I think what really shocked you is when you got similar treatment from American troops.
That did shock me, because I had expected a little bit better treatment from American soldiers, but I often found that they were frightened. They were scared on the ground in Somalia. They were being targeted by snipers almost on a daily basis there. And once, when my car in Somalia had a flat tire and I was stranded and it was getting dark and I was quite frightened and I was trying to hitch a ride, an American convoy came by and they stared straight at me and left me standing there in the streets as I was waving furiously at them, trying to get them to see my American passport. But they weren't taking any chances. All they saw was a black man, to them, a Somali, an African, standing on the side of the road, a potential assassin, a potential sniper. And I learned then from that experience that they weren't looking beyond the color of my skin.
We've been talking about having an AK-47 thrust into your back and things along those lines. There's a lot of slights that you were confronted with along the way, too. And you say of all the slights, the worst were the put-downs by whites, white Africans or European residents of Africa. What are some examples of that?
Well, those were the kind of slights you felt on an almost daily basis in some cases, and especially in Kenya, where I lived. As I said, the situation with having AK-47s pointed at you happened in the war zones, but just daily life in Kenya could be a constant series of such slights. I remember once standing in line at a grocery store and having a white woman, a European woman, step straight in front of me as I was about to go to the cash register to put my items down. And I said to her, "Excuse me, I think I'm here ahead of you." And she heard my American accent and became momentarily flustered and said, "Oh, excuse me, I thought you were an African," as if that would make it okay.
Mm-hmm.
There were constant instances like that, just waiting for service in restaurants and seeing white couples who've come in after I getting served first. And I have to raise my voice and have the waiter say, "Oh, sorry, sir, we didn't know you were an American. We didn't know you were a foreigner." It's because in a lot of these countries, Africans themselves are not treated with much dignity and respect. And you find that foreigners, and in this case I mean white foreigners, are treated with more dignity and respect. And that's what I saw on a daily basis there.
Keith Richburg is my guest, and his new memoir, Out of America, A Black Man Confronts Africa, is about his years covering Africa for The Washington Post when he was the Nairobi bureau chief. What were you expecting to feel when you first went to Africa for The Washington Post?
You know, I didn't really have any preconceived notions. I'd gone to Africa after 4 years as the Washington Post Southeast Asia bureau chief, so I had some experience in refugee camps in Cambodia. I'd had a lot of experience covering issues of development, third world poverty. I'd lived in the Philippines. I traveled a lot around Vietnam. I expected Africa to be underdeveloped. It was, of course. But on a more personal level, I guess I was thinking that for the first time in my life, I would be in a place where I would not be in the minority. And I thought there might be some sense of maybe liberation in that, being able to walk in a country where I looked like everyone else, where I wouldn't automatically be distinguished by the color of my skin. I wasn't quite sure what the reaction would be to me as a black American. I would say I went with an open mind. I had some experience, at least on an academic level in Africa. I knew what I was getting into. I knew that there were countries in the middle of civil wars. I knew that there were going to be problems there. I guess what shocked me, what surprised me, what I guess you could say horrified me, was kind of the scope and scale of some of the violence I saw there. The waste of human life, the way that I saw bodies piled up and no one bothered to take names, and I found that very disturbing. And I guess the conclusion of that was I came back from that experience more convinced, more committed to my own American culture and American values.
Why? I mean, why did you not come back thinking, you know, that what you wanted to do was help reform Africa? I'm not saying you needed to come back feeling that way, but I'm just, you know, wondering what...
Well, I guess, you know, when I came back from Africa, I came back with the attitude of a detached observer, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, as with many, I can still watch on television when I see the scenes of refugees, and my heart goes out to them. But I no longer feel that I have a special connection to the place. I no longer feel that I owe it to any connection I have to Africa to be more concerned than anyone else. I'll send in my check to the Red Cross or whatever aid group is soliciting funds for whatever crisis it may be. But it really made me convinced, my experience there really convinced me that the black people of America belong in America. We've been here for hundreds of years now. Our contributions to American culture are rich and deep. And I think that for those who are holding up Africa as a place where we can walk with dignity and pride, where somehow we still have this cultural and emotional connection, I'm saying that I've been there. I've spent 3 years there and 3 months, and it's not like that. Our connections are not there. Our home is in America. And I think what we need to do is work on making the American tapestry fuller and richer and more inclusive instead of holding out hope that we might find home somewhere else.
Do you think your strong negative feelings about Africa have to do with that for the most part you were covering wars and famines? You were exposed to the worst aspects that any culture can offer. You weren't sent to Africa to cover, you know, what's up at the best universities on the continent and what's it like for the middle class and what are some of the richest cultural traditions Africa has to offer. I mean, that just basically wasn't your beat.
Obviously, when you're a journalist and you end up covering the crisis stories, and in Africa it has more than its share of crises, you know, but it was... In addition to the crises, and I try to make the point in the book, it was a lot of the day-to-day abuses. It was a lot of the day-to-day problems of Africa that just wore me down. I did try. I made a very big point of trying to go to countries that were not in the middle of civil wars, did not suffer from refugee crises. I went to places like Zambia, which had just had a democratic election and I thought was on the path to some kind of democratic reform. I spent a lot of time in some of the Western African states, Gabon, Senegal, places that were not in the middle of any kind of civil war and were on the surface tranquil. And it was just even there I saw that, first of all, the black middle class is almost non-existent at this point. There isn't much of a private sector in most of these countries. And even in places where they do not have the same kind of tribal difficulties or warfare going on, the people are still suffering. They're suffering from undemocratic institutions. They're suffering from a lack of freedoms. They're suffering from everyday indignities. And it was that, really, more than the civil wars and the famines that wore me down. It's just that basic daily lack of dignity in a lot of these places that I did cover. And believe me, I did go around and try to find hope in some countries. And each time I came away just more distressed, actually, at what I saw and less optimistic than I normally am.
My guest is Washington Post foreign correspondent Keith Richburg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Keith Richburg. His new memoir, Out of America, is about his 3 years covering Africa for the Washington Post and how it affected his identity as an African American. How do you deal with this? You end your book by very clearly asserting your identity as an American and saying you don't even like the expression African American anymore because you're just so disillusioned by Africa. Yet I'm sure that there are many times in America when you feel, you know, really alienated and really angry.
Yes, and I say that I say very clearly in the conclusion of the book, as you said, that there are times when I myself feel alienated in America. But having been to Africa, I know that my value system is more American than it is anything else. I think Americans of any ethnic background, any ancestry, we all have more in common with each other than we do with what's on the other side of the hyphen, whether we're American Chinese, American Polish, American Irish, American Arab, or American Africans. I think what we need to do is work on how we can get along with each other, appreciate what each of us has brought into this great American tapestry of ours, and move beyond the kind of divisiveness and resegregating ourselves into duchies that seems to be going on now. And so that's why I think what this book really is, it's a positive reaffirmation of America. And what I'm saying is we should really be working towards creating a society where people really can be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin, instead of holding on to a mythical ancestral homeland that, quite frankly, we left 400 years ago and have absolutely no connection to today.
I guess one of the things I find interesting about the book is that you're, it seems to me, trying to puzzle through how to deal with the fact that your ancestors were brought here as slaves, and yet you've managed to prosper intellectually in America. Do you know what I mean? So on the one hand, you don't want to deny the horrors that your ancestors were exposed to and the ultimate indignity of slavery. On the other hand, you don't want to deny the fact that you've had a very decent life in America.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I think it was the Reverend Jesse Jackson who some time ago coined the phrase, "We may have come over on different ships, but we're in the same boat now." And I actually like that phrase because it does sum up the fact that, sure, our ancestors came here as slaves, and slavery was an evil institution. And I think we need to teach people about slavery and the evils inflicted upon black people. We need to remember Jim Crow and the segregationist laws that lasted really through the 1950s up and including into the beginning of my lifetime. But what I'm saying is that black people in America still have more opportunities, more freedom, more dignity than their counterparts who were left behind. I don't think it's a denial of the evils of slavery, the evils of Jim Crow, to say that black Americans are, you know, on the whole, quite a lot more fortunate than most black Africans, and which is why I saw this among Africans, this great desire to talk to me about America, to talk to me about what it was like being in America, to express this attitude, this sentiment that how lucky you are you were born in the United States. You're very lucky.
I guess part of that perspective depends on class, too. You know, if a couple of generations of your family haven't been able to move out of housing projects where you're kind of under fire by crack dealers a lot of the time, America might look different.
Of course, yeah. And, you know, that's, I think what happens is because there's so much of America that's been left behind in the, so much of black America that's been left behind in the underclass, in the ghettos, in cities like Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Detroit, where I'm from, New York, obviously, Los Angeles, there's a tendency to think that that is black America. And I think we do ourselves a bit of a disservice by not looking at the fact that, you know, there's a good chunk of black America that has made it out. There is a good chunk of black America that is doing quite well and prospering. If you're going to look for most of the black PhDs, if you're going to look for most of the black doctors, if you're going to look for most of the sources of black wealth, I would say start looking in America, and there you can find black Americans who are really achieving. We don't need to look to Africa to find heroes. We don't need to look to Africa to find role models. We have them right here in the United States.
In the beginning of your book, you say that you found that until recently you had to keep the sentiments that you've been expressing a secret. Why did you feel like you had to keep these sentiments to yourself?
Well, because obviously in these times, you know, there are some things that are not sort of correct to be said openly. for any black man to admit that he actually is glad he was born in America and not born in Africa would not be something that would be kind of accepted in the black community. You know, but as I was sitting down to write this book, and I was asked to write a book on my experiences in Africa, you know, I decided I had to be honest. I did not want to just do the standard journalist end-of-tour book where I describe the places I'd been and in a very dispassionate way analyze the problems of Africa, because I decided that would not be an honest book. And I decided that if I were going to put pen to paper, or in this day and age, the fingers to the computer keys, I had to really reach down into myself and bring out these feelings, because I thought that would be the only real honest way I could say that this is the book of my reflections on Africa, and this is what I really feel.
Well, Keith Richberger, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on. I've really enjoyed this chat.
Keith Richberger's new memoir is called Out of America, A Black Man Confronts Africa. He's now the Washington Post's Hong Kong bureau chief. Coming up, David Bianculli with a couple of reasons why primetime TV is about to get better. This is Fresh Air. The competitive period known as the February rating sweeps is over, but that doesn't mean primetime TV will be getting less interesting. In fact, says TV critic David Bianculli, it will be a lot better.
Here's what a sweeps period is. The networks and advertisers take an audience measurement, or sweep, 4 months out of the year, and the audience levels in those months determine how much the networks can charge for commercials the rest of the year. The sweeps months that count most are November, February, and May. And the networks all want the largest possible audience during sweeps months, so they put on stuff they feel can sell to most of the people most of the time. Which, most of the time, means junk like Asteroid. But the February sweeps are over now, and the May sweeps don't start for 8 weeks. This gives TV time to take a breather, rest some hit shows, and take some chances. For people who care about quality TV, this is the time to harvest. This is when all the good stuff pops up. The best of the best are The Practice, a brand new drama series by David Kelly, and Easy Streets, a relaunched drama series by Paul Haggis. These guys already have made some of the most original shows on television. Kelly created Picket Fences and Chicago Hope, and Haggis created Due South. Their new efforts are every bit as terrific. Easy Streets was on TV very briefly last October, but when almost nobody turned out to watch the first two installments, CBS yanked the show and regrouped. If enough people watch it tonight, and when it moves to its regular time slot on Wednesday, then Easy Streets has a chance. If not, it's doomed. But doomed or not, I beg you to watch it. It's essentially a cop drama, with Ken Olin as an undercover cop trying to solve the murder of his partner. Joe Pantoliano is his prime suspect, Jimmy Murtha. And what makes Easy Streets so interesting is that the bad guy, like everybody else in this drama, is full of conflicts and surprises. Listen to this scene, which takes place the morning after Jimmy has bombed the restaurant of a rival mob boss. In the dripping, smoldering ruins of the place, Jimmy and Dugan, played by Pantoliano and R.D. Call, have a very tense but funny conversation.
My business associates and I were thinking of expanding. Things are going very well for me. I don't mean to seem like I'm boasting, especially given your present circumstances, but business is very, very good. Business is great. Business is, what am I telling you for? You used to be in the same business. In any event, we are thinking of expanding in this direction, and I was wondering if perhaps you knew of any space that was available?
The only thing I could suggest to you is to avoid long-term leases.
Ah, yes. That's an illusion. Do you know what an illusion is?
Something that's there one minute, not the next.
No. That's an illusion.
I was making an illusion.
Ah, well, keep it up. Maybe you can make a living at that.
Easy Streets is a joy to watch, just like a good novel is a joy to read. And the same is true of The Practice, which stars Dylan McDermott as a passionate but unorthodox lawyer. Here, too, there's a complexity to the characters and storylines you don't usually find on series TV. Although, with The Practice sitting in NYPD Blue's time slot for the next 6 weeks, it'll be a lot easier to find than Easy Streets. But you've got to find them both. Easy Streets tonight on CBS, The Practice tomorrow night on ABC, Easy Streets again on Wednesday. So far as I'm concerned, that's the start of a TV dream week.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth, our new associate producer. Welcome, Monique. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.